Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For this hour of the program, we have decided to play some best of selections from the TV version of the show, which airs on Friday nights at 7:30 on KERA Channel 13, and then is rebroadcast on this station Sunday evenings at 5. For our first segment, we will listen to last spring's interview with Newsweek International Editor Fareed Zakaria.
How is America's place in the world changing with the rise of new economic powers? And will our current strategy for dealing with change serve us in the future? Fareed Zakaria has considered these questions often as editor of Newsweek International and host of Fareed Zakaria GPS on CNN. His latest book is called The Post-American World. Fareed, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Pleasure to be here.
What will be the most important source of global power in the 21st century? Will it be military might or economic might?
You know, the Chinese government tried to answer exactly the question you're asking a couple of years ago by producing a 10-part TV show, documentary, that traced the rise and fall of the great powers. They called it The Rise and Fall of the Great Nations, I think. And the idea was to really answer that question for them and to help the Chinese people understand. The program was shown again and again on Chinese TV. And the basic lesson they got was that the sources of power in the 21st century are likely to be economic primacy, technological advancement, and a kind of political appeal, the attractiveness of your model. Very definitely not military might. The lesson they drew from the collapse of the Soviet Union was you can be militarily very powerful, but if you're technologically backward, if you're economically stagnant, and if politically you lack appeal to the rest of the world, the whole thing turns out to be a house of cards.
With the Chinese economy slowing down, certainly not to the extent of much of the Western world, will they still be in a position to continue to buy U.S. bonds?
You know, what's happened in the last few months has been really quite remarkable. People thought, well, we're all in this together. The United States is, of course, the driver of the world economy. As it collapses, everybody else collapses. And for a while, it seemed like that. And now you're seeing this resurgence of China, of India, of Brazil. They're not growing at the pace they used to, but as you said, they're growing quite impressively. I think this gives them enormous staying power leverage. Will they continue to buy U.S. bonds? For sure. They will continue to buy some quantity of U.S. bonds, and they will finance our fiscal stimulus, because it's really they who are financing it. But at some point, they are going to say to themselves, you know, we need to diversify. We need to be doing other things. And most importantly, they're going to have to start spending more and more money in their country. You know, they're going to want to do fiscal stimulus in China rather than fiscal stimulus in America. Because right now, how are we doing our fiscal stimulus in America? We're floating bonds that the Chinese buy. So you could imagine Chinese politicians saying, instead of buying these bonds and letting the Americans build bridges and highways, why don't we just build bridges and highways in China for our people? And that pressure will begin to happen. I don't know if it's happening quite yet, but it's a real sign of a power shift where we are dependent on them to do our own fiscal stimulus.
Well, it seems like it will be an interesting thing to observe when the economy does inevitably bounce back, no matter how long it takes, and that money goes roaring back into China as we begin to repay these bonds in significant amounts.
Well, you already are going to begin to see that, I think, because as growth in China stays reasonably robust, it seems like it's growing 6% a year, a lot of people around the world, investors, banks, are going to say, well, I could invest my money in the United States, which is growing at 0% a year, or I could invest it in China, which is growing at 6% a year. I'm more likely to make more money in China. And if that happens, you should see a real shift of a kind of financial power to these emerging markets, to China, to India, to Brazil, because people are going to realize that the industrialized world is saddled with debt, is going to grow more slowly. There's going to be greater government involvement. Perhaps all of this inevitable, but these are not conditions for very robust growth. And that will mean that China and India become more attractive as places for investors, for banks.
It seems to me that there are a couple of different questions when it comes to the U.S. sort of staying on top. There's first the question as to whether we have the right to preserve our primacy by whatever means necessary. But what's even more interesting to me is people who argue that we have an obligation to do so. Does a stable world require the United States to be on top, both economically and militarily?
Well, you know, this is at the heart of my book, and what I try to make people understand is sort of two points, as I like to think about it. One is that the shift of power is inevitable. There is nothing we can do to stop the rise of China. There's nothing we can do to stop Indians from leaving villages and working in cities and, as a result, raising their national income and their economy. The second is we shouldn't fear it. We shouldn't sit there thinking, you know, how do we prevent this? How do we stay on top? This is a bigger, more interesting, more complex world. The United States will have a central role, perhaps even the central role if we play our cards right. But it won't be what it was once. I mean, we will not be in a situation where we can dictate to the rest of the world what we want them to do. We won't be in a situation where we can say, you know, East Asian economic crisis 10 years ago, here's exactly what all you countries have to do. We're going to write all the checks, so, you know, you better listen to us. We don't, you know, we 10 years later, look at what's happened. We don't have money. We need them rather than they needing us, or at least we both need each other. So we're going to have to learn to lead in a very different way, through setting an agenda, through persuasion rather than kind of a dictation. I think it's actually good. It's healthy for us to have to try and persuade people that we have the right ideas rather than tell them, you've got to do what we say because we're the 800-pound gorilla.
You've written about the idea that we need a grand strategy for sort of planning out the future. When is the last time that you think this country had an effective grand strategy in place with regard to foreign policy?
Well, certainly the most successful grand strategy was after World War II. After World War II, the Truman administration, Harry Truman, comes into office, and the United States dominates the world like no country has ever dominated. We were 50% of global GDP in 1946-47, mainly because the rest of the world was flat on its back. And what Truman decides to do, and the people around him, George Marshall, Dean Acheson, what they decide is, rather than using this power to preserve a kind of imperial U.S. hegemony, what they're going to do is try to build institutions that will create a degree of peace and stability and prosperity. And that's where you get the UN, that's where you get the Marshall Plan, NATO, the World Bank, the IMF. All these things were kind of created as a network of organizations to bring about a certain degree of peace and stability. And in doing that, we very powerfully helped the United States because, of course, we benefit from a peaceful, stably, orderly world. What we need is a similar kind of rethinking, which is, okay, the world is changing, power is shifting, it's being decentralized around the world. How do we create systems that will bring in these new powers, China, India, Russia, Brazil, so that they feel like they have an investment in a new world order, so that they feel they have an investment in upholding the new rules rather than sort of, you know, trying to kind of get around them or freelance. If we do that, it's great for us. I mean, this is one of the great lessons of Truman's success, was that if we do good things for other people, it helps us enormously. Because we are, at the end of the day, what we want more than anything else is a peaceful, stable world in which people can trade.
You know, when you mention UN, IMF, NATO, these are some of the most criticized organizations in the world, by many accounts, deeply flawed, in particular the UN. Can the systems we have in place now be reformed to the extent that they're truly effective for this world, which is very different from the days of the Marshall Plan? Or do we need to look at starting something from the ground up that will take their place eventually?
It's a great question, Chris, but let's begin by saying, you know, all these institutions are flawed. I, however, start from the presumption that all human institutions are flawed. Yes, the UN is flawed. Yes, the IMF is flawed. I think what we've discovered in the last few years is Goldman Sachs is also flawed. Wells Fargo is also flawed. Bank of America is also flawed. You know, there is no magical institution that doesn't have bureaucracy and corruption and problems. I think that the reality is we're going to have to do a little bit of both. There isn't an intellectually clean answer. I think that, for example, the UN Security Council, which is in some ways at the center of this issue of, you know, kind of political management, It's a real problem that it doesn't have Germany, it doesn't have Japan, it doesn't have India, it doesn't have any country from Africa, it doesn't have any country from Latin America. So where's the legitimacy? And that's what I mean in terms of, you know, reforming, kind of bringing in these new powers. You can't say to them, we want you to pay for more of the bills and provide more of the troops, but by the way, you're never going to have a seat at the table. So what do you do? It's tough to open up the Security Council because the existing powers don't want to do it. It's like a private club where, you know, it's like a golf club where there are a limited number of tea times. And, you know, the existing members are very happy, thank you. They don't feel like they need any more. Maybe what we'll do in that case is there's this new group that's called the G20, the 20 largest countries, largest economies in the world. Maybe we go that route. Maybe the UN still does some things because it is unique in that every country in the world belongs to the UN. And that gives it a powerful legitimacy that we don't quite appreciate in America, but you go anywhere else in the world. And there is a real sense that the UN has that legitimacy because it's the only truly global body. So, you know, it'll be a little bit of a la carte multilateralism. We'll have to do a little bit here, a little bit there. My argument is, and I try to make this point in the book again and again, go for what works. Don't get hung up on ideology. If in this particular case you can get, you know, you can get results using the UN, use it. If in another case you can use the IMF, use it. In any case, what is clear is we can't go it alone, that we just don't have the resources, we don't have the legitimacy, not because people view us as big and bad and evil, certainly not after Obama has been elected so much, but it's just nobody wants one country calling the shots.
You are listening to The Best of Think. That was Fareed Zakaria, the international editor of Newsweek, and he was on our show, our television show, last April. We are bringing you The Best of Think today because this is our fall membership campaign, and we wanted to give you a taste of what we also produce on the TV side. Of course, it also airs Sunday evenings at 5 o'clock on this radio station. My name is Chris Boyd. I am here with the senior producer of both Television Think and Radio Think, Jeff Whittington. Hello, Rex.
Hi, hello, Matt. Margaret?
It's Rex and Margaret, our alter egos when we're doing TV.
Rex.
I don't know where they came from.
Wow. I don't know what to say. Except, well, I guess I could say the phone number. 800-456-5372. Rex.
You know, if I'm not on my regular schedule of things and I'm not, I just lose it. I went and had some pasta salad.
I know.
I don't know what to do.
What are you doing eating at 1 o'clock? Okay, so it's the fall membership campaign. The overall goal, $600,000. We're $324,000 of the way there.
Halfway.
We're over halfway. We'd really like to get to 330 raised by the end of the hour. So that means we've got to hear from you at 800-456-5372 or online at kera.org.
We have wonderful news for you today. Our good friends at the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas have donated a $500 money card. This is basically like a free prize, and it's, you know, they put it on plastic for you and you use it like a debit card. This is something that we're going to draw for today between 6 and 6:30. All contributions from all day from, I'm sorry, I got this wrong. We're going to draw for it at 6:30. From 6 o'clock this morning until then, everybody who's made a contribution today is entered into this drawing for a $500 money card from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. Very nice thing for them to do. Hopefully it will help us to raise money. That's why they do it, because they care about KERA.
Sure.
So make your contribution now, and you could walk away with a fabulous gift just in time for the holidays.
Yeah, you make a $250 contribution, you might win a $500 money card. It's like a credit or debit card. So call 800-456-5372. You have to contribute today to get a chance to win this drawing. You can also join online at KERI.org. Everyone who contributes will get entered into this drawing. So please call 800-456-5372.
You choose the amount that works for you. Maybe it's $120 or $240 or $365 or $5,000. You know what works. You know how much you listen. And you can certainly put a value on that. Give us a call now at 1-800-456-5372. You can ask the folks on the phone any questions you might have, remaining questions about a KERA membership. You can also get to us online. That is at kera.org. Make your safe and secure contribution there. We do ask to hear from you now, though. 1-800-456-5372. Thank you.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For this hour of the program, we have pulled together some of our favorite excerpts from the archives of the TV version of Think. Last spring, we talked to Newsweek international editor Fareed Zakaria about his thoughts on the post-American world. We'll pick up that interview now where we left off in the last segment.
Well, going back to this question of multilateralism involving specifically the United States and its allies and partners and nations with which it doesn't get along, will we have to rethink the very different way we treat different countries? For example, as the president is discussing possibly lifting some sanctions on Cuba, a lot of people are pointing out that we tolerate behaviors from Saudi Arabia and China that we sanction Cuba for.
I think that it's a wonderful question. What I think we're coming to the end of, I hope we're coming to the end of, is the really bizarre set of double standards that we have on all these issues. You know, as you say, we tolerate things in Saudi Arabia that people then tell us we should invade other countries for, or we should, you know, use military force in Pakistan. Somebody pointed out, you know, there was this beating of this woman in Pakistan in the Swat Valley because she had gone out of the house. And people said, this is why we need to militarily fight the Taliban. Fine, but let's remember that just 2 weeks earlier, a 75-year-old woman was sentenced to 75 lashes in Saudi Arabia for doing exactly the same thing, leaving the house without her husband's permission. When nobody's saying we should go to war with Saudi Arabia. I think what we have to try to understand is the world is complex and diverse, that there are many countries with different political systems, different cultures. We can't bomb them all into becoming American. We should engage with them. We should push our views, particularly on human rights, particularly on women's rights. We should never, you know, be quiet about that stuff. But the use of military force to socially and re-engineer people into Americans does not have a very good track record. It is much better, I think, to have a kind of long-term civilian engagement in these places. Cuba is a perfect example. We have achieved nothing with the sanctions policy in Cuba. We've had a policy of regime change in Cuba since 1959. The Castro brothers are the longest-lived rulers of any country in the world. That should tell you that it's not working, and that maybe if we had overwhelmed Cuba with trade and contact and commerce and they had been able to come to America and we'd come, I have a feeling that would cause the Castro regime to fall a lot faster than, you know, than this kind of punitive policy of sanctions. These regimes hate contact with modernity, hate contact with capitalism, hate contact with, you know, the minute you do that, that's when it all starts crumbling, as it did in the Soviet Union.
In a truly multipolar world, Fareed, how does the life of the average American change from what it is right now?
Probably the biggest difference is that the average American is going to have to get used to the idea that you are dependent on all these other countries and forces around the world. It's the end of the free lunch for America and for Americans. So you can't say, I'm just going to borrow, and not worry about anything. Because the reason you can borrow is because America was given a free pass by the rest of the world. If any other country had engaged in the kind of reckless borrowing we did over the last 20 years, their currency would have collapsed, they would have had to raise interest rates, because that would be the only way to get capital in. Well, America, everyone said, oh, you're different. You can do whatever you want, and it doesn't matter. And the average American is going to have to get used to the idea that he or she has to live by the rules, that, you know, I mean, simple common sense rules. You can't have more than you pay for. You can't keep borrowing. You can't have, I mean, the average American has 13 credit cards, 40% of which have balances on them. This is all made possible by the free pass, the funding that was provided by the rest of the world, no questions asked. Now you see the Chinese saying, wait a minute, we're very concerned about how you're running your economy, and we have the right to say this because we're the ones financing it. And in more broader terms, you know, if you work at a company, you have to be much more sensitive to the fact that in most of the S&P 500 now, 20 to 30% of their profits come from abroad. In many of the top 50 companies in America, 50% of their profits come from abroad. That's going to mean foreigners in your workplace, in your management, on your board. We've gotten used to the idea that, you know, globalization is Americanization. It's that we get to go around the world and sell our products and buy things. But it's now becoming a two-way street.
Fareed, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. You just heard the Best of Think interview we did last spring with Newsweek International Editor Fareed Zakaria. Changing topics now, we will hear from one of our favorite repeat guests on the show, journalist and memoirist Lee Woodruff.
Which takes more strength, creating the ideal existence for yourself and those you love, or learning to be happy with the way you actually live? Lee Woodruff has coped with a lot of hardship, including the traumatic brain injury that her husband, ABC News anchor Bob Woodruff, suffered on assignment in Iraq in 2006. But she has come to find joy in embracing not only her greatest challenges, but also the everyday frustrations of real life as a working wife and mother. She writes about it in her new book, Perfectly Imperfect, A Life in Progress. Lee, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Your first memoir focused on such an intense time in your life right after your husband's accident. This one takes a much broader look at things. Was the experience of writing it totally different?
It was totally different because this book is a funny book for the most part. It's a book where we can all look at all the little things that make up our lives and join us together. But there are really serious moments in this book, too, and I wanted that to be on purpose because I wanted this book to make people laugh, to maybe make people cry good tears, but also to realize that we have so much to be grateful for in our everyday lives.
I know that you have done a lot of work on behalf of people who have traumatic brain injuries since your husband's attack, and I'm wondering if you spent a lot of time thinking about how much worse it could have been for him.
I spend so much time thinking about it because, as you said, we're so involved with especially the military who returned from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan through our foundation. And I've met so many. I've been honored to meet so many of these families. So many are from Texas. You have sent an inordinate amount of your sons and daughters to war. And every time I see one of these kids or fathers or sons or husbands who hasn't recovered the way Bob has, it makes me catch my breath and think, that should be Bob.
You write about after the time he came home being the most stressful because suddenly you've got all this to deal with and you're still not sure if everything's going to be the same again. And finally, after sort of resisting for a while, you made the decision to take antidepressants for a while. I'm wondering if you had it to do over again, if you would have made that choice much sooner.
I think I would have. I think I fought it for so long, and I'm really proud of that chapter. It's called Chutes and Ladders, and it's the part that happens after the adrenaline dies. And for any caregiver out there, for anybody who's been in that situation, nothing can stay up forever. And so I write really honestly about what it feels like to be in the middle of a situational depression, which a term I'd never heard before, which is essentially things happen in our lives that are bigger than we are. And it's okay to ask for help. It's okay to reach for something. And I think I was trying so hard to be that strong person that everybody thought I was, that I was really falling.
Well, I wonder if trying to be that strong for a while actually kept you going for your own sake, and then there's a point at which you just run out of steam.
I think it did. Absolutely. I mean, if you tell yourself you're strong and everybody else is, and you're plowing through it, especially when you have four kids to take care of, you need that up, and you need to be up. But then at a certain point, when Bob was home, and he still was missing his skull, but he was not the Bob that I knew because he was very much in recovery, you don't know where it's going with a brain injury for a very long time. It's the slowest organ in your body to heal. So somewhere about 6 months into it, I just thought, where are we going to end up as a family? And that's when I began to falter.
The other undercurrent of things throughout the entire book is that even when there's not a crisis imminent, that you're sort of just always going. And I feel like I could have written the chapter where you write about multitasking and your approach to multitasking as opposed to your husband's.
I love that chapter because it's really also about driving and about my analogy that a marriage is a lot like being in a car. And that's where Bob and I tend to have some of our worst fights because I have no sense of direction and he does. But I'm always astounded when I look at him and have through our 20 years of marriage, he has been unable to do two things at once. Then someone finally clued me into the fact that this was actually the way male and female brains are physiologically wired differently. So it made me forgive him just a little tiny bit. Not all the way, but just a little tiny bit.
And there's sort of a technological solution now to some of those arguments, right?
Right. GPS has saved my marriage. And so we fight a little bit less, but I really am annoyed by her voice at times. And my husband, I really think, is enamored of her. And we call her Bossy Boots. That's the name of our GPS system in our car.
Yeah, I've got one on my phone, so it's quiet. But
wow. Yeah. Okay, you're good.
One of the other things that you're dealing with is trying to help care for your father who has Alzheimer's. Can you talk a little bit about that push and pull between taking care of your kids and what they need and then sort of watching your parents decline?
So many people I know are in that position right now, and they call it the sandwich generation. But I would like to propose the new terminology, the panini generation, because I feel like we're really pressed between that white hot heat between taking care of our young children or our older children, and then being a parent to our parents, which is a difficult role. And I write about that in the chapter called My Dad, because it's sort of the sadness of being in the middle of in that transition when the seesaw tips. You know, first you're the child, and then somewhere in there, almost without recognizing it, you realize that you're being the parent. And it's a very sad and poignant moment for those of us that are lucky enough to have our parents live this long. And it's coming to terms with that this is really the greatest gift I can give my dad and my mom, is to help get them through these years, which are not easy.
Well, and it's really interesting because it almost strikes me as, you know, when people talk about never quite being ready to have children, I don't think you're ever quite ready to see your parents sort of lose the ability to take care of themselves.
I think that's really true. Yeah.
Was it hard to let your mom read the chapter about your father?
That is a great question. This book was a manuscript last summer, and so I brought it up to where we all go and get together as a family in the summer, and I pulled this chapter out because I didn't want my mother at that point to read about my own pain, and I also didn't want her to read it to my dad. And I knew that by this point in time when the book came out, sadly, my dad would probably not be able to read the chapter, which is true. And it's a very personal chapter to me, but it's a chapter I wanted to share because there are so many people out there going through this with Alzheimer's and dementia with their parents. And my mom has read it, and she's very proud of it. There's nothing in the chapter that trades on personal information. It's just the sadness that one feels as a daughter, you know, watching all this take place.
That is Lee Woodruff that you have been listening to in an interview that we did on the TV version of Think last May. My name is Chris Boyd. I am here with Jeff Whittington. We're doing Best of Think for this hour of the program today, hoping that you will find it within yourself to send some money for the Best of Think and the Think that you hear all the time. We try to always make it the Best of Think.
It is your show here, locally produced on your public radio station and your public television station as well. You know, the Think series is, we cast it as sort of a multimedia series. You can see the TV episodes on the web at KERA.org, where you can also contribute to the station. You hear those television interviews on Friday afternoon, on Sunday at 5 o'clock here on KERA, and you get a few chances to see them on Channel 13. So it is kind of a TV show created with the same idea behind it as this radio show that you're tuned to right now, that you listen to maybe every day. All we're asking you to do is to help support this kind of programming with a call to 800-456-5372.
You can also make your contribution online at kera.org. We are working to finish our fall fundraising campaign. As we've told you before, we only will raise until we get to $600,000. That's our goal for this drive. The people who deal with money at the station tell us that is what we need to raise to keep the station strong until the next time we come to you for fundraising, months and months from now. We are just as eager as you are to get back to regular programming, but we figure it's honest to come to you and say, look, this is what we need in order to preserve the station that you like, the independent, locally owned and programmed station that exists for you here in North Texas. 1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. If nothing else, make a contribution for all the people in your life that you wish would start listening to public radio.
We have heard, thank you very much, by the way, from Ashley Keith in Carrollton. Thank you, Ashley. Stoney White Jr. in Fort Worth. And Jan Doherty in Dallas, thank you so much, Jan, for your contribution today.
Also, Forrest Barber in Fort Worth, Colin Walsh in Dallas, and Rose Taper in Plano, thanks to y'all. And Stephanie Lee in Coppell, John Floyd, a new member from Nevada, Texas, and also Denise McQuinn Amir. I hope I'm having trouble seeing that, but Denise, you know who you are. Thank you very much in Dallas. We sure appreciate it.
800-456-5372. Online at kera.org. The programming that you're hearing this hour is, we're calling it the Best of Think, a couple of interviews from over the last year that you may not have heard, and they're very interesting subjects, very interesting people. We try to do that every day here on the show, and it's only possible because people like yourself, because people who listen have chosen to send some money to the radio station. This is your public radio station, so we're asking you to do your part right now at 800-456-5372. 5372. If you're interested in a thank you gift, if you like the Think Show, we do have the Think Mug. We haven't really talked about this so far during this membership campaign. It's available at the $60 membership level. It's a 14-ounce black ceramic mug with the Think logo on it. And you can get that. You see it on the TV show. When you watch the TV show, you see our guests drink from these mugs. So you can get your very own when you call 800-456-5372. You can also check it out online at kera.org.
My parents drink from nothing else, but they can't take them all on. There are still a few out there for you to obtain. You know, and it's a nice little thing. Look, we know you're not buying a $60 coffee mug. Frankly, this isn't worth anywhere near $60. What you are paying for is the content that you listen to every day. But if it would go down a little sweeter drinking out of a Think mug, we would be delighted to send you one.
And of course, a set of 10 is available at the $600
level.
Membership level.
Call we can scale.
That's right. Call 800-456-5372 or look at it online at kera.org. We are going to hopefully close this membership campaign out this week. We can do that with your call, with your online contribution. You know, we'd really like to finish it sooner than Friday, but our goal is to try to wrap it up by Friday. We can close this drive out if you'll call 800-456-5372 or contribute at kera.org.
We are at $325,000 raised now. The goal that's been given to us by the membership folks is to get to 330 by the end of this hour. That gives us 20 minutes, but you know, if everybody listening who's been thinking that between now and the end of the drive we'll make a contribution made that call right now, we would easily get to 330,000. That would keep us on track to end the drive as soon as possible. I want to thank folks like Jerry and Marion Davis in Richardson, Tim Haynes in Frisco, and Diane Parker in Plano for your support this drive.
We also heard from Sarah El Sharif in Arlington. Thank you so much for your contribution. Remember, everyone who contributes today, either on the phone or online, gets entered into a drawing. It's going to take place tonight during Marketplace. All you have to do is contribute something to the station at 800-456-5372 or online at kera.org and do it between 6 a.m. this morning and 6:30 p.m. this evening. You're entered into a drawing to win a $500 cash card. This is like a credit or debit card. It's worth $500 from the Gay and Lesbian Fund for for Dallas, who've made this available because they generously want to support KERA as well. So we'd like to thank them. Thanks so much to the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. And also thanks, North Texas. Thank you for your contribution and your support of KERA.
If you are waiting to make a contribution, ask yourself what you've been waiting for. It's a rainy day. You will feel warm on the inside as well as hopefully on the outside after you make this contribution. The phone number is 1-800-456-5372. We are always around online at kera.org. You can check out thank you gifts there if you are so inclined.
It is your choice, of course, to listen. It's also your choice to support the station. We hope that you will choose, and I'm asking you to please choose to support it. Again, the phone number, if you don't have it memorized already, if you've been thinking about calling it, 800-456-5372. And don't forget, you can also support the station and check out the thank you gifts online at kera.org. We'll be right back. Thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. For our final Best of Think segment this afternoon, we will hear the conclusion of my interview with Good Morning America Life and Family contributor Lee Woodruff, who joined us on the TV version of the show last spring to talk about her life in the years following the traumatic brain injury of her husband, correspondent Bob Woodruff, who was nearly killed by an improvised explosive device while covering the Iraq War in 2006.
I really love the chapter that you write about your teenage son and the sort of the poignancy you feel as he pulls away from you and needs you less than he used to. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I was so sure when I had my son that I would all of a sudden be open to all the mysteries of men, because I had no brothers growing up, and I really wanted to make this child, you know, this wonderful, sensitive, loving human being who would be great to women. And he is all of those things, but I think that what I realized, and so many moms have validated this, is he just really doesn't talk. He's not sharing all those things with me. And of course, that's often a boy, not every single boy, but that's just what a boy does. And at the end of the chapter, we've had these little moments together. He's gone to get his driver's license, and we've gone on some college visits. And at the end of the chapter, he begins to kind of, somewhere in the last 8 months, kind of say, I'm going to bed, Mom, if you want to come up. And to me, this is like the biggest blessing, the biggest invitation that he knows and I know that he's about to leave to go to college in the fall. And I think we're both on our own levels just trying to let each other know how much we're going to miss one another.
What's really interesting about it is that although it's something that I think a lot of families can relate to, it also feels very much like sort of a love letter to your son that he wouldn't tolerate you saying all these things to him if you sat him down on the couch and tried to say it.
It's true, but, you know, I went in to wake him up the other morning, and I just started sobbing, like, a total...
Who's this man?
Right. That's exactly what I did. I was stroking his little hair, and I just started sobbing, and, man, he woke up fast. I should have tried this tactic, you know, 3 years ago. And I said, I'm okay, honey. I just realized I only have, you know, about a month and a half left of this before you're gone. And he looked up at me and said, Mom, I'm never really going to be gone. I'm always going to love you. And I was like, you know, sobbing even more. But I thought, you know, we don't have to say those words all the time. And that's the kind of the beauty of being a mom. And no, I don't expect that they're going to appreciate everything I do until they have their own kids. But that's okay. You know, that's just part of the process. And the best thing we can do is give them all the right tools to head out into the world.
It's remarkable that I think you never really know how much your parents loved you until you have that same love for your own children.
Isn't that true? I know. I finally got it. I had a different relationship with my mom, not a close one. I loved her to death, but I wouldn't want to have shared things with her. And yet when I had my first child, I'll never forget calling her up and saying, Mom, I get it. I get how much you loved me. I understand all the things you did for me. You know, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to wait a few more years.
When you found out that your younger daughter, one of your younger daughters, was deaf, you write about having felt really stressed in that just as you're dealing with all this, and your husband cared as much as you did, but he's off at work, and you're having to deal with it. Can you talk about that sort of isolation and how you cope with it?
There's so much in that chapter. It's called A Different Ability, and it's really about Nora and how I see her quote-unquote disability now. And I love that chapter because it's a fill-in-the-blank, because we all want to have more than anything a healthy baby. That's our biggest wish for our kids. And when things fall short, and they often do because nobody's perfect, there's a grieving process that takes place as a parent. You know, you'd cut a limb off for your child, and so you wanted everything for that child. And so when I found all of this out about Nora at 9 months of age, Bob was far, we were living in London, he was on the road all the time, and I had this one sort of grief-stricken moment where I'm talking to him, and he's in China, and I can barely hear him over the satellite phone, and he says to me, Nora's not deaf, and I'm enraged at him, because I say, you're not here, you're not going through these tests, you don't know what this is all about. And it's a moment where I turn all of my anger about this on him, as we often do to those that are closest to us. And yet he's gracious about it, and he understands my grief. But at the end of the chapter, it's really the coming to terms. It's my process of understanding that this isn't a disability for Nora. It's just a different ability. And she will go through life, and she will be just fine because this is all she knows. And all of the worries I had about her, who's ever going to ask her to the prom? Will she hear her own baby cry? Will she ever be able to go to a concert or talk to her friends in a crowded bar? All of those are just diminished by the realization at a certain point that Nora will move through life the way she's going to move through life.
On the other hand, there are many moments in the book, including one in which you take all of your kids solo to Orlando to do the theme parks, which I have to tell you, I think you deserve like a medal and a
Thank
diamond
you.
Ring. And, but there are many moments where, as a mother, you don't want to reveal to them that either you're having a hard time or you're just not having a good time.
Right.
And I wonder if, even in accepting for yourself perfect imperfection, you still can't quite get there when it comes to your children.
That's a great question. I think that's been a journey and a process for me because I think especially my loving husband, you know, expects, you know, king of the soccer team, 98% on tests. And it's been a process with him to sort of say, they're going to blaze their own trail. Mac does not want to play soccer at college. That's okay. He's never going to be a professional soccer player. So I think it's that give and take. I was actually always the mother who looked at her first child and said, wow, looks a little bit like Yoda. And the other mothers would be like, oh, my baby's so beautiful. And I remember thinking, my baby's not beautiful, but maybe he will be later. So I feel like I've always had this maybe a little bit too sort of Klieg-like glare on, you know, life and imperfections. Will you tell them that? Will you say to them, oh, you're a mess, go change that shirt, or is that...
Yeah, I will. I don't think I'm the Eddie Haskell mom where I'm picking out every little imperfection. But I feel like we spend half our time, I bet you feel that way too as a mom, just correcting things and repeating things. And that's all part of the process that's going to get them ultimately to be these fantastic human beings. But it's boring half the time.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing about being a mother that they never tell you about is saying brush your teeth 100 times in the same week.
I know. I lose it at that sometimes. I just say, guys, I've said it 7 times. I'm a nag. I sound like a nag. I don't want to be a nag.
But it's funny that you do go through this where you in talking about your son, going off to college, you can't wait for the moment where you don't have to do that anymore, and yet you don't dread anything as much.
I know. I often really wish that we could freeze dry these moments, because I know as a 65-year-old, I'm going to crave a day where I'm saying brush your teeth 5 times, because I'm so lonely sitting in my little house in my slippers. You can't do that with life. You just have to deal as it comes. And I think that's why we all just need to learn to focus in on some of those moments and just embrace them, because they're going to be gone.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how your relationship with your sisters has changed, especially in caring for your parents?
We are so in the thick of this right now. You could not be asking me this at a better time. I find myself on email all day now while I'm on the road, just trying to make sure my folks are okay. They're going through a little bit of a rough patch here, and I think we're in a transition from my dad's care. And my two sisters are amazing. They have really picked the slack up while I've been out talking about the book. We'll all be together this summer, and I hope to be able to pay them back a little bit. They don't expect it, but I'm so fortunate to have sisters to do this with, and they've really been terrific.
Has anyone in your family asked for veto power before you put the book out to press?
I gave everybody a chance to read it. I can't say that my children pored over it. Let's just put it that way. But I made my son read the Mothers and Son chapter. Mm-hmm. In fact, I did what I think is a fairly clever thing. I gave it to his girlfriend first. Mm-hmm. And she actually was crying when she finished it. And she said, oh, Mrs. Woodruff, this is beautiful. And I thought, right answer. Right answer if you want to get in with me. And so then Mac read it. And he said, Mom, this is okay. You can do this.
Do you keep a diary? Is that how you sort of keep track of things as you decide you're going to write about in life?
I don't really, but I just write a lot, and I'll dump little tidbits and snippets into different places on my computer. I stopped keeping a diary when Bob got injured. The world just blew apart. I stopped doing their little scrapbooks. I stopped so many things that were part of my ritual. And I never was great about keeping a diary in any, regular fashion. I would just write when things happened in life. And that's sort of what I still do, and then just throw them somewhere so I can kind of call them up if I'm thinking about them.
Briefly, is there anything you didn't understand about your life until you sat down and wrote it?
Wow, that's one of those questions you got to go away and think about for an hour. I think there's still so many things I don't understand about my life. I think there were things I didn't understand about me, maybe, that I'm perhaps not as type A, and that I'm more forgiving, and that I'm stronger than perhaps I thought I was. And I'm constantly amazed at the resiliency of the human spirit in general. I mean, just watching Bob recover, first of all, our own abilities to recover from things are amazing, and our ability to bounce back.
Lee, thank you so much. It's been great.
I've loved it. Thank you, Chris.
The new book is called Perfectly Imperfect, A Life in Progress.
And that was our interview with Lee Woodruff that we did last May. We are rebroadcasting it to you as part of our Best of Think show for this hour of the program. My name is Chris Boyd. I'm here with the senior producer of Think Radio and Television, Jeff Whittington. And we were just talking. Lee Woodruff really is. She's been on the show a couple of times. She really is so down to earth and so wonderful. And it's fascinating to me that with the kinds of very serious and substantive discussions we have, that there's room for a talk like that about real life issues and about telling your kids to brush her teeth. It's wonderful to be able to have an outlet for so many different kinds of thought about so many elements of life. And you make that possible with your support specifically of this program.
Perhaps you heard them, Lee and Bob, her husband, when they were here 2 years ago, I guess, to tell their story about Bob's recovery from traumatic brain injury. I mean, a major part of his skull was missing after the explosion that he endured in Iraq. And their recovery from that as a couple and as human beings. And then, it was thrilled to have Lee back in May And you likely will hear from them again at some point because they come through, and they're great people to talk to. And we know that you enjoy hearing from folks like this, people who've had amazing experiences who want to share the story with you. And that's what we try to bring you every single day here on KERA. And, you know, contributions this past year have helped the station pay for all the equipment that's necessary, the electricity that's necessary, help pay for everything that has to be in place for us to be able to broadcast these kinds of conversations. So if you have gotten something out of this, if you've listened, if you've enjoyed it, if you've just learned something, or, you know, if you just want to take responsibility for the fact that listeners help pay the bills here, the number to call is 800-456-5372, or go to the support page of KERA.org and make a contribution, because we'd like to wrap up this membership campaign this week. We really don't want to be doing this next Monday.
Chances are you don't agree with every guest that we have on this show. Chances are nobody does, because that, you know, we look at so many issues from so many different angles and entertain so many perspectives that it would be odd if you said everybody who came on here represented exactly what you think about something. That's okay, because, you know, as we often joke and sometimes say very seriously, we name the show Think and Not Believe because we respect you to listen and to enjoy the content and to interact with it, and then make up your own mind. We have no desire to tell you what to think or even how to think. We just want to give you things to think about, and we so appreciate the fact that so many of you tell us when we meet you that you love listening to the show. We would just ask you now that we have the floor, that you make a contribution so that it's possible to continue bringing shows like Think, like All Things Considered, like Morning Edition, like everything you listen to on this station, to you every single day of the year. Our telephone number is 1-800-456-5372. We're also online always at KERA.org.
Special thanks to John Booth in Denton, also Celeste Baron in Plano, and Joanne and Gary Duncan in Trenton, Texas. Thank you so much to Mary Cronkey in Plano, Sandra Baker in Alvarado, and Don Louis in Flower Mound. We'd love to thank you, but you got to call 800-456-5372 or go online to KERA.org and make a contribution. Still looking for your contribution this hour. We've raised $326,000, but that doesn't mean that we don't still need your help, that we can't still use your contribution to help end this membership campaign this week. And don't forget, everybody who calls and contributes or contributes online gets entered into that drawing.
Maybe you're sitting there listening to this thinking, they're not going to get me, they're not going to convince me to give to KERA. And I would ask you what you're really gaining and what you're really hanging on to by not making a contribution, and why somehow that feels like a victory to you. I understand it completely, because I am I love to resist a sales pitch for something I don't need. But public radio is something you do need. You prove that by tuning in every single day. The cost for your public radio membership is up to you. You know what your budget affords and allows. Just ask yourself what your bank statement says about your values. And if you value public radio, you value learning, maybe you've been to the bookstore 15 times in the last year, surely you can carve out a little something for public radio. Do it on a sustaining membership, and, you know, maybe you just do $10 or $15 or $20 a month, and it's easy, and it's a great contribution for us.
It's very, very easy to support the station. It just takes a couple of minutes when you call 800-456-5372, when you contribute online at KERA.org. It takes about 90 seconds to fill in the membership form, a little longer if you want to peruse the available thank you gifts and choose one of those as a thank you to yourself. And of course, we're happy to send you a thank you gift to thank you for contributing. When you do contribute, you're supporting KERA 90.1 Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. It's your source for NPR news. And also, we stream online at KERA.org. You're supporting everything you get from KERA. And you're supporting the fact that the station plays an important role here in the community. If you think that public broadcasting and public reporting and public radio news and information is important to the world, then please make a contribution right now. It just takes a minute, and it's really vital that we hear from you. Don't let someone else pay for the fact that you listen to the station. Don't leave it up to someone else. Take responsibility and make the call to 800-456-5372.
And don't miss the opportunity for a feeling of enhanced ownership of KERA. You know, people who join the station often stay on year after year after year. It's often not a one-off thing, because once you become a member, you realize that it makes you feel great. It makes you really feel part of the formula. And I would ask that you try this. Make your contribution at 800-456-5372, and then next time you run into somebody out in the community who works here, whether it's an on-air person or a support person who works maybe harder than Jeff and I do behind the scenes to keep everything running, tell them you're a member and see if whoever that person is doesn't give you a sincere thanks. And you can see it in our eyes. We really are grateful. And we're grateful whether you are a huge, major gifts kind of member of KERA or you are a very basic membership, a few dollars a month member of KERA. We appreciate your support. We want to thank folks like Lauren Fletcher in Dallas, a new member. Welcome, Lauren. Karen Johnson in Dallas, John Mullen in Dallas, and Raul Singh in Coppell. Thanks to all of you who have called.
We've heard from about 52 of you at a whole bunch of different levels. We raised about $4,000 during the show today. So we would love to hear from you at 800-456-5372. We did hear from Cynthia Wyatt in Wichita Falls. Thank you so much, Cynthia. You can also join online at kera.org. You know, you do it because you understand that it costs a lot to bring this kind of programming to North Texas, and you want to help out. You want to make sure that the resource is strong, that it's here now and in the future. So please call 800-456-KERA or join online at kera.org. And don't forget, you get into that drawing for the $500 money card provided by the Gay and Lesbian Fund for Dallas. So you got to contribute to get in that drawing.
This is your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. You can become our next member by calling 1-800-456-5372, or you can make a contribution online at kera.org. We sincerely appreciate you listening, and we sincerely appreciate your financial support. Thanks.
The Think team includes assistant producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.